All right, everyone, welcome to Office Hours. It's July 1st, 2020. My name is Eric Osterman, and I'm going to be leading the conversation. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator. That means we help companies own their infrastructure in record time by building it with you and then showing you the ropes. If that sounds interesting, head over to cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. Again, that's cloudposse.com/quiz. To get started. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered. So feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can join these live and interactive sessions by registering at cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/officehours. We host these calls every week. We'll automatically post a video of this recording to the Office Hours channel, as well as follow up with an email that you can share with your team. Well, with that said, let's go ahead and kick this off for today. So here are a couple of announcements that came to mind. I just want to bring up that I realized I did not share my screen. You guys got to catch me on that. I do that all the time. So yeah, here are some announcements I'd like to share. First is that, you know, we've been investing heavily in GitHub Actions at Cloud Posse for a number of reasons. One is that anybody who clones our repos can get the same benefits of GitHub Actions without needing to sign up for any other services. Two, GitHub Actions are really dry and reusable. We can centralize them and reuse them across all of our repos. And since we manage hundreds of repositories, GitHub Actions have been really good for that. So one of the things to point out here is if you guys are using Go, we have some great examples of some GitHub Actions for doing that. Looks like the one I linked to, I did not merge actually. So hold on, let's actually do that on the call. All right, so let's merge this GitHub Action. And I'll show you what's cool about it. So one of the things at Cloud Posse, what we always do is on every merge to master, we always cut a release. And that is so that, you know, end users can get the benefits of everything that we're doing, the bleeding edge. But for stability, you can always pin to a version, which we recommend. So I just cut a new release there. So for the GitHub Actions, if you go head on over to Cloud Posse Slack notifier. This is really useful if you have some CI pipelines, or if you're using Atlantis, for example, which doesn't support Slack integrations. Technically, I think it has something, but it's a feature flag that nobody knows about. Anyways, moot point. You can use Slack notifier for that purpose. And what's nice is that our releases always ship binaries. This means that you're able to get, you know, you don't have to be a Go developer to know how to build and compile and check this out. You can just download a binary release and use it. So you'll notice that 0.3.0 that I just cut doesn't have it yet because those pipelines have kicked off. If we head on over here to Slack Notifier, these are the pipelines that you could copy into any of your repos to get these same benefits. So here's our action for a Go application with the various steps. So it's going to build it for all these different architectures, upload the artifacts to the job that ran. And then if this is a release, then it's gonna upload the artifacts to the GitHub release automatically. So we can just rubber stamp this now to every one of our repositories anytime we need to have a binary release for one of our projects. Any questions on that before I move on? Cool. So the other thing that we've been working on here is, you know, we've as a company embraced Alpine tremendously. And that was originally kind of where we saw the tides were turning, but proven to be a lot of problems, largely because Alpine doesn't use libc. You know, it uses that other one, the lightweight one, I forget what it's called. Somebody fill in the name for me. So we're looking at adopting Debian as our default minimal image for a lot of our projects. So right now, a lot of our projects are using Alpine, as you can see. See here from Alpine. But we want to support Debian. The problem with that is we maintain a lot of packages. So if you're not familiar, Cloud Posse has a packages repo. If you head over to github.com/cloudposse/packages. And this is our tool chain here. So these are all the different tools that we depend on as part of our engagements that we work on with customers. Many of them are Kubernetes centric. Many are just like great tools for pipelines like JQ or YQ. So stuff like that. So these are distributed as Makefile targets. These are distributed as Docker images. These are distributed as Alpine packages. Maybe I already said that. And now we need to distribute them as Debian packages. So that's what I'm working on right now, is making sure that we can port our packages distribution to support Debian. I bring this up because if you're using Cloud Posse tools, you might not have known about our packages repository. It's a great treasure chest of cool tools that we curate and use, and also that you might want to be able to easily install just by using Alpine packages or Debian packages. So check out the README here for more details on why we have this. Any questions about our packages repo? Cool. Terraform testing. So we are drowning under pull requests at Cloud Posse. We maintain a whole ton of projects. If you see here, 332 repositories, and they're pretty much all actively maintained. I mean, just look at the status here of when these projects were updated. And, you know, you're going to see a couple dozen few dozen updated in the last week. And that goes across all our projects. So that means we also get a lot of pull requests. And we formed a contributors team at Cloud Posse, made up of volunteers from our community that are interested in supporting the code reviews and contributing to that. And I just want to give a big shout out to a few that have really stood out. Pepe, you know, God bless you, man. You've been a big help to us reviewing, you know, probably a couple dozen pull requests in the last week or two. And Matt Gowie and RB and Andrew Roth, I know you've all been stepping up to the plate too. So I really appreciate it. And anybody else who's interested in being a contributor, please reach out to me, especially if you've been doing a lot of pull requests against Cloud Posse modules. We would love to speak with you. The good news is for everyone else is if you're using our stuff, hopefully your pull requests will get reviewed faster now that we're investing heavily in improving this process for everyone. It's just not easy when you have this many repos. All right, next cool thing. So our tests, we're using TerraTest extensively throughout all of our modules. Basically, that runs Terraform of plan, apply, destroy, and catches like 80% of the problems you might have just doing those things on your modules. Sure, you can do testing of functionality that they actually do what they said to do. Law of diminishing returns on that. So what we've had encountered though is there are a number of resources that are orphaned sometimes when tests fail or even upon destroy. Elastic IPs are an example of that. If you're using EIPs in your tests, when you destroy the resources, those EIPs, I believe, continue to exist until you release them in the UI. So this has caused some problems to us. We can keep raising the limits and keep paying more for that, or we can nuke them. There's a cool tool many of you have probably heard of throughout the years. It's called AWS Nuke. There's a GitHub action for this now too. So if you head over to cloudposse.testing.cloudposse.co, you can see how we're now nuking our testing account every night. So we free up these resources and these orphan things that we don't care about. So there's a workflow for that. It's very simple. Basically, on a pull request, we do a dry run. Then on a cron schedule, on master, we actually nuke everything. So we're running on the official rebuy AWS Nuke Docker image, passing it our custom config, passing it our secrets from the GitHub organization, And this is where you see here we run the dry run on schedules. We do the no dry run, which is what they call the flag. So that's why I called it this this thing here. But so then we do that on the schedule, and then on every pull request, that's when we just do a dry run on the nuke file. So nuke configuration is pretty straightforward, but you will spend a good hour or two getting it first figured out. If you want to be selective and explicit about what you're nuking in your accounts, that's what I did. Since we will never, there's no chance that this would run in any of our other accounts. This is just a no op value, so to say. This is a blacklist of accounts. If you're running in a different context, you might want to change that. But so these are the resources we're automatically nuking. These are our default presets. So Amazon provides a number of default resources. We just want to let those be. We're not going to nuke those. So I spent some time to just come up with the expressions to ignore all the default resources in the account. And then here are all the blessed resources we don't want to destroy ever in our account. Since it is a testing account, but there's still foundational infrastructure in there for Atlantis, IAM roles. We don't want to nuke that stuff. We want to nuke everything else that comes from our tests and testing. And that's why we have these white lists here. So it wasn't immediately clear, but filters are basically white lists of what you don't want to nuke. Any questions on AWS Nuke? Cool.
Eric, do you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Does dependency become problem when running Nuke? I mean,
good question. Yeah. So basically, you're saying that AWS resources, you can't destroy the VPC until you've destroyed the subnets.
And
you
We have a lot of problems.
So AWS Nuke takes a naive approach to this, from my observation at least, and it works really well. Basically, it does a multi-pass approach. First pass, it tries to delete everything it can. It gets rejected on a bunch of stuff. That's fine. But the things that was successful on, it waits for them to destroy. Okay, those are destroyed. Now it does another pass. It tries to destroy everything again. It succeeds more now. It waits for those things to destroy. Okay, those things are destroyed now. Then it does another pass. And it keeps doing that until after multiple consecutive passes, it fails to destroy resources. That's when you know you have a cycle and you need to first update your configuration to make sure you're nuking any dependencies. So okay, to answer your question, yes, it does. In a very naive approach, but works well. I think one thing I didn't show is if we go over here to GitHub, Cloud Posse, testing, actions. It's pretty clear what's going on. So here's AWS Nuke. It ran on a schedule. I can click on this. You can see it ran the no dry run. So this was for reals.
Hey, Eric, we can't see what you're showing there.
Oh,
yep.
Did I stop? No. Thank you. I'm using the wrong
different window.
Yeah. Oh, thank you guys. You're getting to know my Achilles heel there. All right. So here's an example of a testing account, AWS Nuke running. Here's the output of that. You can see filtered by config. So these are the ones that I have explicit rules to ignore. And looks like there was nothing actually to nuke in this run. So the account was actually clean. If we go back to like an earlier one, let's see, a couple days ago, let's see if this did anything more interesting. And nothing was nukable there too. So we could go hunting through these. It's probably not that interesting. If you want, all these actions are public. So if you want to look through these, you can see the previous runs and you'll see somewhere where they actually do their job and clean stuff up. Cool. Any other questions related to AWS Nuke? I Again, this is ideally suited if you're doing any kind of infrastructure automated testing, and definitely wouldn't run it. If you don't have a dedicated testing account, I probably wouldn't even try using a tool like this. Just the risk isn't worth the reward. But we do have a dedicated infrastructure testing account since we test a lot of untrusted code. So it definitely is paying for itself on that. So the other problem I hinted to is pretty cool. I think it was Matt Gowie that turned me onto this tool. You know, we have the, hundreds of repositories. If you're in a larger enterprise and practicing microservices and you have some consistency across your projects, you might be in the same boat as we are. There's this cool little tool that is still actively maintained that is called MP, I believe. It allows you to run operations across all repos in your organization that match a pattern. It will handle the discovery of the repos. It'll handle the checkout of the repos, creating the new branch, opening the pull request, doing all that stuff. Into a single CLI tool. So I think this was pretty cool since we have problems that we typically have is like we need to update the README across all of our repositories, or we want to add chat ops or add some GitHub actions to all of our repos. Something that's coming up almost imminently here is with 0.13 Terraform, we're going to need to update the provider pinning in some of our modules to allow it. That's another bulk operation that we can do. And since we have testing, we can open these things all up in bulk, but then the test will catch if there's a problem with it. Any questions around MP? I'll share this in the, I forgot to share the other links too in the Office Hours channel. I'll do that right now.
Do you have any examples of using the? Do you have any examples of using that package against a number of your repositories?
Actually, we do. We haven't merged them yet. This is pretty early in our exploration. Matthew shared it. Let me see here if I find it in our channel here. He is on vacation today, so.
One of our use cases that just came from management is because GitHub is trying to change its master branch to the main branch.
Right.
And the whole removal of oppressive language and everything. This tool would come. It would be very useful. Because we could run like quick scripts, like a sed script or something like that, and automatically do a pull request. So I would absolutely love to see a live display of this if possible.
Yeah. So I have it here. I believe he posted them. Let's see here. Here are the five repos that he opened up. And you can take a look at those. I'll post that into the Office Hours channel.
Thank you.
In our case, we have the build harness, the Cloud Posse build harness, which allows us to centralize a lot of that logic. And he was able to run this, he ran it against it and it generated this pull request here that runs a migration to implement chat ops, for example, for one of our Terraform modules. So yeah, check out Microplane, which is the tool. I linked it in the Office Hours channel there. Microplane. Nice little Go utility. All right, so yeah, those were just the announcements. I wanted to now jump into some talking points. A lot of questions were posted in Office Hours. Let's see what we can get through. All right. So first question, from you, Burkhan, what is the recommended approach to stream the output of a background job running in a server to a web application. So you list, you know, a couple technologies here like CloudWatch, WebSockets, you know, FluentD, Logstash. I think it's going to require a collection of these tools. It's not a project I've had the opportunity to work on. Maybe there's somebody who has more relevant, timely experience working with this. I know there's a lot of apps, WebSocket streaming services out there that allow you to make it easy to bridge the gap between the web front end and the back end for streaming this. Obviously, on the back end, you might have technologies like Kinesis and Kafka and all those things, but you're going to need a bridge at some point to the browser. Marcine, have you worked with this?
Yeah, kind of. So then, but it's hard to say a specific solution where we don't know the problem. The problem is because we can spend a lot of money on it, but eventually it comes down to should it be real-time logs or can it wait? Because the cheapest solution there is for backend application to just send logs to S3 and the web fetch it, right? This is a simple solution, foolproof. Durability is 11 nines and availability is also pretty good. So it depends on the needs of the application. But if we're talking about the, let's say, fancy solutions, I think there are some cool solutions. And WebSockets, yeah, I think this would serve well if you want real-time and addition with some real-time streaming services.
Yeah, AWS has a service for this, for streaming WebSocket stuff, but I haven't worked with it or played with it. Anybody have a more interesting, valuable feedback here for Burkhan?
Sure. I used essentially Elasticsearch to stream events, and then the UI just pulled from that with Kibana or directly. Mm-hmm. It was fairly real time, but you get the advantage of all of Elasticsearch facets and counting for you, which is significant.
That's good advice. But did you have a front end? Did you have a proxy layer for authentication in front of the Elasticsearch then? Or?
Well, we were able to do the Elasticsearch essentially in the same private subnet. Mm-hmm. So security was not relevant there because it was all within the same.
So you did streaming to your backend service and then your front end was talking to your backend service.
Yeah. So we would have a proxy between the public subnet and the private subnet.
Yeah. Not
Using,
bad advice at all.
David, I didn't understand the name of the framework. Can you please repeat the name of the framework you use for this?
No, so he's just using Elasticsearch, which natively supports streaming.
Okay.
So basically what this is saying is that your services, whether your services be emitting to STD out and it goes through your whole like FluentD log forwarding setup, or your application is logging directly to Elasticsearch, both are okay. The key is that Elasticsearch becomes the technology that you're using to facilitate the streaming. Now, what size, are we talking like one or two consumers reading this data, or are we talking like dozens and dozens or hundreds of consumers?
No, only one consumer.
Then I think you probably just want to go this simple route that David suggests.
For example, in AWS, you start a process and you see the results. You tail to the logs. There's an option. You tail to the logs. It's like that.
Yeah.
You start a background job and you will tail to the log because it's a very long job. It takes about 20 or 30 minutes.
Mm. Are you already using CloudWatch logs? So this is something that would be easier for you to use?
Yeah, I'm using CloudWatch for cloud build because it's pretty much integrated.
There's a CLI tool for CloudWatch logs to tail them. I've seen a few of them out there. Here's a nice little one in Go. Looks like it's recent. It's actively.
I know, and I use this. This is a client tool. However, this is not a web tool. It's a very, very good tool. I use it a lot in my bash scripts.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for a...
Or strictly on the web website.
Web application solution, yeah.
Yeah.
I use this tool pretty much.
Are you familiar with Kibana?
Kibana?
Yeah.
Only heard of it by name. Swedish name, I believe.
Well, Kibana is essentially let's just simplify it. It's a dashboard for Elasticsearch. So it's the built-in web search for what he's looking for.
Mm.
It takes a little bit of time to get used to it, but if you're looking for kind of a free solution.
AWS has a hosted service for that. Like it has the ad stack. So you can hook a Lambda to the CloudWatch log groups and it can stream it to Kibana. But then it depends on how much you want to spend on that. And
yeah, Elasticsearch. I mean, if you're not using Elasticsearch as part of the solution already, I mean, it's going to add a minimum of a few hundred dollars a month, to $500 a month just for that. So probably want to, if you're shipping it already to CloudWatch logs, probably want to go with a native solution for that. I don't know, just like this is not maintained, so I wouldn't recommend it. It hasn't been updated for 2 years. But it looks like somebody else has written a very simple Node.js server just to stream your CloudWatch logs that you could tie that into whatever you're working on. What languages are you using today as part of the solution you're building, Rikhan?
We are using React.
React, okay.
Yeah, in the front end. And
on the back end?
And the backend Node.js.
Okay, so perfect. So this would be maybe a good starting off place for you to take a look at. At least for inspiration.
And who will be the consumer of this web page? Is it going to be like business users or is it like ops people or are you going to use it for troubleshooting?
Developers, and they are not end users. Developers will be the consumers of this web page. It's actually a DevOps site, too.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, I don't know if you need to build an app for this, though. Like this, you know, the developers might want to just be using whatever logging dashboards you have in place today. And if you don't have that, maybe it's worth building out those logging dashboards.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. All right, let's see what else we got under the talking points for today. All right, so David, you had a question on CubeSpray. It is in the Office Hours channel. I guess, I don't have any experience with it. First, I just want to see, does anybody else here on the channel use CubeSpray? If so, then let's see if we can help answer this. Otherwise, we might not be the best help. Anyone on the Zoom today a CubeSpray user?
In theory, it's not specific to CubeSpray.
Okay. Well, we'll give it a shot. Scrolling up here on my Slack history here. So David writes, this question might be specific to CubeSpray. I want to set the kubelet certificate authority flag in the kube API server. I chose /etc kubernetes ssl_ca.cert, but that's probably wrong. Let me tell my story. After adding the flag, I tried to get logs from a pod and I see the following error message, basically cannot validate certificates. Because it doesn't contain any IP SANs. Then I changed the kubelet preferred address types to internal DNS. This changed the messages to using, internal host names of AWS. Seems like the host name was known and changed it. And I changed it to using internal DNS host name. This changed the message to...
You may want to put this onto the, since you're recording it, display what you're reading.
Yeah, I need to, let's see here, open copy link. I'm reading in my own Slack client here, so I'm
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a good point. Yeah, I'm just opening it up in my browser so everyone else can see it.
If you weren't recording it, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, no. So I used to share my entire screen, and then you guys would see everything. Now I got like one of these stupid ultra-wise, and it's just ridiculous to share. So here we go, though. So this is David's question. Basically, yeah, you're right. I mean, this is not necessarily Cube Spray specific, but your TLS certificates are not being validated. So the CA is probably not found in the certificate chain.
So the certificate that needs to be changed is actually on the worker node, not the master node, right?
Presumably, it depends where the pods are running, but yeah. So Cube API server, yeah, it's nothing I've dealt with lately, so I'd have to get my head around it. I can't just jump out. It's pretty much in the weeds here.
Yeah, these are the kinds of issues that I've been dealing with. I'm trying to get through the CIS Kubernetes benchmark.
Okay.
Right. And so this is one of their flags that we should have this set.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, also, like, so you're using KubeSpray, so you're not using EKS, in other words.
No.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Because the environment we're going to go to is essentially an enclave.
Okay.
So we won't have that. We won't have EKS available.
Yeah. Any? I know we have a few certified Kubernetes admins lurking on the Zoom here frequently. Anybody know the answer or have any thing you'd like to contribute?
Okay.
All right. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry. We'll move on to the next one. Let's see here. Open source cloud native VPN. This was asked by Muhaha. He and his Slack question is up here. Let me see where that one was posted. I think I need to scroll down. Yeah, here. So Cloud Posse has a solution that we worked on, but to be entirely honest, this was something we implemented a few years ago and isn't actively maintained. So what we have here is a Helm chart that deploys OpenVPN with a OIDC proxy, the Bitly OIDC proxy, and GitHub OAuth to generate short-lived certificates for OpenVPN. I would use what we use these days if you want a solution that supports SSO with OpenVPN that's more managed. We use Pretunnel today. Pretunnel, it is. I believe it's like open core kind of model. The more advanced single sign-on options require a dirt cheap license for unlimited seats. But it's a much more beautiful user experience using Pretunnel. We have a Helm file for it. So if you're using Kubernetes, go to cloudposse.com/helmfiles under releases. Here's our Helm file for Pretunnel. It might not work for you out of the box, but at least it gives you the gist of what you need in order to operate Pretunnel under Kubernetes. There's a demo, you can check it out. So I'll link Pretunnel in the conversation. Marcin, I think he's asking about point-to-point VPN.
Site-to-site.
Site-to-site, yeah. So actually, I forgot to open it up here. So here's the original question. Any idea for open source cloud native VPN supporting OIDC VPN?
It seems like open source and cloud native is contradicting here. Isn't it?
Well, I guess cloud native meaning easily deployed and open source being free. I think that's reading between the lines, the hope and desires. All right, let's see. Next question. Is upgrading a Docker image in an ECS service with zero downtime? This was asked by RB. Let me understand though what you mean by zero downtime. I mean, rolling updates is not what you want, or what is not good enough, or because I mean, it's ECS natively supports zero downtime deployments, so. Need to know more information.
Eric, yeah. So thanks for adding my question here. The question's a little bit hard to interpret just, as it's written without adding some context. Okay. So the context itself is, so basically what I've noticed at my new job is that a lot of people are foregoing the task definition being managed by Terraform. So so when Terraform creates the task definition, we basically have a life cycle life cycle ignore changes in there for the task definition, which I'm sure you've probably seen a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
It's pretty common, and it makes it difficult because now you have you have a task definition that's managed in two different places.
Yeah.
And if it's not done correctly, then you could have people stomping over their task definition and just deploying their services accidentally.
Yeah.
So I've noticed this at my place, and the way I've seen it being managed here is. So initially we create the task definition using a homegrown service module. Once that task definition is created, subsequent applies should not affect that task definition.
Yeah.
And now the task definition will be managed by a fab file. The fab file, this is where it gets a little gross. It basically is a fab file that's been copy-pasted over across, you know, a number of repositories, and it basically recreates the task definition. And so in order to avoid that, I was thinking about trying to push more on just having the task definition managed by Terraform.
Yeah.
And I realized too that whenever I change the task definition and apply it, ECS will knowingly try to deploy my new service task definition correctly, and so far it seems like a zero downtime approach, but I wanted to also make sure if this is okay. If this is the right way to do it.
No, that's a good setup, and let me just add some context for everyone else listening in here. So so the problem is that Terraform isn't works really well for deploying ECS tasks and services and definitions. The fundamental problem is that most people don't run Terraform in the same pipelines as they do their applications. So that means that you need to first, if you want to do this as part of your routine deployment processes in your company, you need to also build the competency of running Terraform in those same pipelines. Now, that is somewhat easier said than done. And that's because doing Terraform operations isn't as clean as doing web app deploys, because like web app deploys, something goes wrong, you can either pause it and leave what's running in place, you can do an easy rollback, you can go back to other versions. With Terraform, there's no concept of like rollbacks. Like something breaks during that deployment, you're screwed. For example, a lot of people practice GitOps with Atlantis using, applying Terraform stuff, but then they have their CircleCIs, Codefreshes, GitHub Actions, Jenkins doing everything else. So now we're spanning two different CI systems, and there's no easy way to trigger like Atlantis to just roll out the Terraform stuff while you do your application, testing and whatnot over here. Is that an accurate depiction of your current state?
Yes, that is very true. The pipelines for our Terraform are different than our pipelines for deployment to production, and we're trying to see how we can kind of converge those. So
yeah,
we can have one-to-one infrastructure between Terraform and AWS and destroy any drift, and also solve this problem with these fab files that have kind of got a little bit out of hand.
So the reason, therefore, why people have gravitated towards ignoring lifecycle changes to the ECS task definitions, just adding this because I forgot to add it, is because of all these other predicaments. Is that because you're not running Terraform already in it, it's harder to do it. And replacing the task definition is a simple, like, one-line AWS CLI command. And that's why that's been the go-to way for a lot of these tools to deploy. So there are other tools like ECS. There's a few tools called ECS Deploy. I think one is more popular than the other. I don't remember which ones those are. I just want to point this out. Like, if this is still an appealing solution, maybe going with a more conventional tool might reduce some of the tech debt evolved with this. But I get your point about sticking in one tool. So let me get to that now. So first thing I'd like to propose is Terraform Cloud something even palatable for you guys? Because what's really nice about Terraform Cloud is that it integrates nicely with your existing pipelines, because you can just trigger it by a webhook. So when it comes time to deploy, your application can trigger a webhook to run a plan and apply in Terraform Cloud. And then that goes through the whole Terraform Cloud ecosystem. So like, if you need to apply Sentinel rules, or if you need to have approvals, if you need to, you know, trigger other projects that need to run because this thing updated, that can happen. And this is why I've just acknowledged that running Terraform pipelines in anything but a system built for it is non-trivial.
That is something we have considered, not for this particular use case, but we have evaluated HashiCorp's Terraform Enterprise, and you know, because of the whole coronavirus and the lack of liquidity that we now face, I don't think we will be able to afford that.
How big is your team?
Right now, our DevOps team is about 5 people, and we're at a company of 200 employees.
Yeah, so you're pretty big. So yeah, surviving on the free tier might not be reasonable, or if they even have the free tier still. I think it used to be free for teams of less than 10 for a certain subset. All right, so shy of that, what I would do then is I would adopt the Terraform Cloud pattern, if that makes sense. So the pattern here is that you trigger a plan and apply workflow via webhooks, and then you implement that logic in your CI system. So the logic you're going to need is to have a plan, to stash the plan as an artifact somewhere, to have an approval, and then to, when you apply, is to unstash the plan, possibly have another approval to apply, then roll that out. This way you can centralize where the keys are for plan and apply. You don't need to have that in all your repos. You're going to need to have elevated IAM permissions for this type of capability to run with Terraform.
I see. Okay, so that definitely makes sense, and that has been so far our first plan.
Okay. Cool.
Well, one of the other issues that might be blocking this is that the way we tag our Docker containers, we tag them with the first 7 characters of the Git log reference.
The short commit SHA kind of.
And that's in order to prevent using a tag like latest, because as Matt pointed out, that was an anti-pattern. And one thing that I talked about too in that thread is in order to forego using the latest tag and instead using a tag such as like we could use a tag such as staging or a tag such as production. And if we set our task definition equivalent to that, then we would no longer have to update our task definition. And then all we need to do is, within our build pipeline, all we need to do is then push up, build another artifact, still tag it with the first seven letters, but also tag it with production or staging, ship that up, and then run what Matt suggested, which was the force update command. And that should retain the current task definition, use the same Docker image that we just pushed up, and redeploy the service with zero downtime. And that was the specific solution I really want to get vetted.
Well, so yeah, what I don't like about this, and it's been kind of an anti-pattern in at least the Kubernetes ecosystem, is static tags like this. The problem is that, yeah, it represents something, but you don't have any issue. You have to spend a lot more time investigating if it's actually what's been deployed, or that you're running the same SHA everywhere. So if you're my understanding of this is like you would have like a tag called production, right?
Right.
And that correspond, yeah. So I wouldn't recommend that, because what you want is the act of changing the tag triggers the deployment, because that's the only assurance you have that something is actually running on that version. And then your tags become immutable. What's not nice about like the latest or the production is that they're not immutable. They don't represent a point in time. I guess they kind of represent a point in time, but it's not a verifiable point in time. Like this could be a running production tag at that point in time, but it didn't update for some reason, and you don't have an assurance that you're running the same version everywhere.
So we also considered that, and right now we have a status endpoint across our services that basically returns that same Git reference as well as the current tag that it's using. So that's one way we were thinking, well, we can still verify the current version that's running and possibly take advantage of this forced deployment.
Yeah, I've seen that done too. And I've seen it where like you can like even have your health check endpoint then return a bad status code. The one thing you want to avoid is anything that could lead to a forced outage. I personally don't like the solution, and I don't see it practiced anywhere at all. But I'm speaking for, you know, the engagements that we've worked on.
I can jump in and say that I think additionally this will complicate the setup, because you need to check if everything is deployed with the correct SHA. And you need additional system that will do that, and you need additional monitoring for that. So this is eventually complicating things for me. The good pattern is to have shared services account, or where you keep the Docker and use the same Docker image everywhere. This is good. Then you actually, which is immutable. So this will ensure that you run everywhere what you actually know that is running.
Yeah.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. So this kind of points out that we're also running both of our environments in the same account, and which is another issue. We really need to separate our environment and accounts, and then be able to transport the same Docker artifact across environments. So that's a really good point. So what I'm hearing is, a recommended solution from you guys is that the best way to approach this problem with the current parameters of this one massive account for our environments is keep doing the same thing with the Docker image being tagged using the first seven characters of its Git log, but don't create any generic tags like latest, production, or staging, and instead, when we want to update the task definition, we will just re-tag it, and then we have to combine the Terraform apply with our production build of Docker. So one way we could do that is when we're building the Docker container, And once we've built that Docker container, we can then tag it, push it up, and then take that same tag and feed it into that Terraform module as an input variable, and then have that input variable then trigger the change to the task definition, apply that task definition using an auto-approve. Hopefully there's only that one change, and then that should be enough to trigger that deployment for the environment that we're building in.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
You got it. Let's see. I think we had one more question maybe. Yeah, I don't know if HS is on the call. Are you around? All right, we'll just do a quick answer on this one. It's come up before. What APM would you recommend for a Java-based application? And I can easily deploy on my Kubernetes cluster. So it sounds like since you wanted to play it on your Kubernetes cluster, maybe you mean implicitly open source as opposed to paid. Obviously, Datadog is one of the more popular APMs these days. Datadog does deploy onto Kubernetes, but it's not open source, and you do pay for that. The other option has come up a number of times. I forget who it was who initially brought it up. It was you, Andrew Roth, or I think it was somebody else. So Elasticsearch supports APM. I believe it's part of the open source offering now too, Elasticsearch APM. And let's see here.
Yeah, so I'm not using it, but yes, the APM is free to use now on Elastic as far as I remember.
Beautiful. Yeah, so I think it looks pretty legit. You know, I don't know how it compares or stacks up to Datadog's, but it looks pretty clean based on the screenshots.
Also, there's New Relic, which also supports APM.
The original. Yeah, I'm going to post this in the thread. I'm thread here, so Elastic APM. I'll post it the channel as well. Cool. Well, that brings us to the end of the questions that were prepared in the Office Hours channel. Let's see here. B asks another question in the channel here. Let me open it up in my browser. Let's scroll down to Office Hours. All right, B asks a question. I found a Terraform AWS COPS Vault backend repo and was wondering if you guys have an infrastructure where Vault is running on Kubernetes cluster with other Kubernetes clusters authenticating and pulling secrets from that singular Vault using a mutating webhook secrets injector. We've been using bank vaults and have been unsuccessful communicating due to COPS internal certs. We use AWS ACM to handle SSL. Trying to wrap my head around what certs are required and where and how to debug this. So yeah, I'll say that the COPS vault backend, that was something we worked on probably 2.5 years ago with another customer. I don't know what the status is of it. Honestly, what this did was it provisioned the encrypted S3 bucket and the IAM credentials to support running Vault. This predates, though, so much of the new stuff in Vault, like the automatic KMS unsealing that made its way into the community edition. So I would take this with a grain of salt and look at it as something maybe to get started. So to answer your other question about having kind of this this trusted cluster running Vault and then pulling secrets or injecting those secrets into another cluster, we haven't done that. The current state of what we're doing with this is one of two things, using a few solutions depending on what we're doing. So if we're running services that consume secrets, regular Kubernetes secrets, we've had pretty good luck using the AWS secrets operator. This is by Mumoshu. And it's fallen into a little bit of disrepair lately. The commits have slowed down. It doesn't support some of the latest and greatest with the AWS Secrets Manager. There's a few other operators. So my point is, I personally gravitate towards solutions that use managed secrets backends like SSM or AWS Secrets Manager, because it's such a fundamental capability of your platform. I don't want, I don't want a forced outage. I don't want a unenforced outage of Vault causing a forced outage everywhere else when we can avoid it. So that's why I like using the operators that just pull secrets into Kubernetes from one of the other stores. Of course, that means that you can trust Kubernetes secrets, which, that might not be possible for all organizations. Obviously, Kubernetes secrets are not as hardened as HashiCorp Vault. So, anybody have something they'd like to add to this?
I like the pattern. I'm not sure if many companies use it, but I like the pattern to hard code the secrets in Git repository and encrypt the crypted with KMS. So Terraform can do it out of the box, but the applications on the start, for example, needs, if they have variables which are KMS encrypted, then they need to have permission to decrypt it, and they need to decrypt it in a like a pre-running stage, something like that.
So on the one side, I think it's an elegant solution. I really like the exploitation of
using public keys. It's really cheap.
It's really cheap. It works. It's proven. This has come up before. I was just going to link here. Somebody else asked, for a sanity check on this, and I gave my 2 cents on it. Gave pretty much the same answer I gave you guys today, though. what I don't like about it, though, is that you can break a lot more than one secret in doing this, and you don't have opaqueness in the pull request process. The person changing it still needs to have full access to every secret as part of, encrypting that file, re-encrypting that, editing and re-encrypting that file and putting it in into source control. So mileage may vary depending on the company.
So the company that I worked for, we had the tooling around that. So that was really easy to decrypt and encrypt new secret. And actually, you don't need to change them too often.
Yeah, it's the tooling is very easy these days with Git Crypt or whatever it is, or Git. There's extensions to Git to simplify that and manage it. So you're right on that. Just randomly sharing that link that I referenced. So we're almost out of time for today. We got another 2 minutes. Any quick thoughts before we wrap things up for today?
Yeah, I got a quick question. Oh, sorry about that. Via the whole Vault and secrets thing, I'm wondering if SSM is a good solution if we plan on having Kubernetes clusters on GCP as well, or is it AWS?
But I mean, you bring up a good point, but there's like kind of law of diminishing returns, and I think optimizing for the lowest common denominator on both platforms isn't always going to get you the best outcome. I think that if you standardize how your apps consume secrets, so that they're using Kubernetes secrets, they're exposed as environment variables, if you can tolerate environment variables, right? Not all companies can even tolerate secrets and environment variables for certain reasons. But then how do you get those into Kubernetes on GKE? How do you get those into Kubernetes on AWS? I think you can optimize for the best solution on each.
Got it.
Question for you, Brian, does Google Cloud offer an equivalent of a secrets storage?
I'm not sure about that. We haven't explored that option yet. That's why I'm trying to use Vault to get secrets onto everything. So in the case that we do move to GCP,
yeah,
it'll probably work.
Another thing that was just announced, I mean, obviously this is bleeding edge, but HashiCorp has now announced a managed cloud. I believe it offers Vault. I think it does. I'm going out on a limb here. I just know that they offer a managed cloud now for a lot of their services. So if it's palatable, you can now maybe outsource your vault. All right, let's, unfortunately, we got to wrap things up for today then. Appreciate everyone sharing. I always learn tons from these events. I hope we were able to unblock some of you on your questions. Look forward to seeing you guys on Office Hours next week, same place, same time. Again, if you haven't registered for Office Hours, go to cloudposse.com/officehours. And a recording of this call will be posted to the Office Hours channel in a few hours. So check that out. Feel free to share it with your team if there's anything interesting for them to see. All right, that's it.
Thanks.
Thank you guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.